You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. This is the American Hour, and you're listening to the USA Talk Radio Network. And, of course, I'm joined by my lovely co-host, Paula Lausanne Osman. How are you doing today, Paula?
Doing great, Tom. How are you?
Excellent. I'm feeling really good today, and I'll explain in a minute. But first, I want to say, Feliz Cinco de Mayo to everybody out there. Are you familiar with the Cinco de Mayo celebration, Paula? Any Mexican restaurants in your area, they're going to be promoting it. Cinco de Mayo, and come on over and have some margaritas, that kind of stuff. Out west, we get a little more play out of it, and you know where I grew up, Arizona and California. But how much do you know about Cinco de Mayo?
That's just that it's a Spanish holiday held every May 5th, and that's pretty much it. I don't know that there's any, that there's a Catholic background behind it or, you know, what made it come about.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of people don't know, and that's why I bring it up. I just wanted to explain to people and let people know. But it's during our own Civil War, the French thought they might be able to not infiltrate but affect us. Now, you know, they helped us break away from the Brits, the French did. Now, on down the road, and I don't want to get in the whole history of it, but Napoleon, you know, he played around by giving us the Louisiana territories, but thinking he'd spread us out, and even thinking, now this is my opinion, thinking that, because we don't know why he just dumped that in our lap. He needed some money at the time or wanted it, but at the same time, he thought he was going to be able to get it back, and he thought he could disrupt the Union. In any case, the French invaded an area called Puebla in Mexico, and it was the Battle of Puebla with the French forces where the Mexican army was greatly outnumbered, but they won. And I guess one of the kind of important things about it is the last time any kind of European nation has fought or invaded North America. Now, we tend to celebrate this like it's a big deal, and everybody thinks that the Mexicans celebrate this when, in fact, they really don't. It's mostly celebrated by Americans in the U.S. Why we celebrate it, I think it's just a good excuse to have sort of a, hey, Mexican food day, margarita day, listen to Mexican music day, and of course, Americans of Mexican heritage, it's good it's a way to celebrate something that's not necessarily celebrating, for example, say, Mexico's independence. It's kind of bad form to celebrate the independence of another country, you know, that's not your country. And especially if it's maybe neighboring your country. It's one thing to recognize it, but then to have a big celebration in your country, no. But Cinco de Mayo, another story. It's not, you know, their Independence Day or anything like that. So we have fun with it. Yeah, but it's a much bigger deal in the U.S. than it is in Mexico. I think if you were in Mexico City today, there wouldn't be much going on. There'd be plenty of people eating Mexican food, of course, but not because of Cinco de Mayo. But I just wanted to bring that up, and we used to have fun with that out in California and every year in Arizona when I was growing up, Tucson, Arizona. Now, of course, Nancy and I are going to celebrate it today by having Mexican food, and I have already been to the grocery store and bought all the fixings to make steak fajitas. And the way I do it is I've got a big sirloin steak, a big, huge sirloin steak that is marinating in salsa right now. And a little after this show is over, I'm going to go out to the grill and put it on the grill and grill it up until it's just about done. Bring it in the house, sit for just a little bit, then carve it up. In fact, it's a big piece, so I'm going to use an electric knife. That's the easiest way. And then I've got a bunch of peppers, green peppers, red peppers, cubanelles, onion, and then I've got some scallions just to throw on there afterwards. And then I was thinking ahead a couple days ago. I bought, maybe it was yesterday, our grocery store near here does not always have the best avocados. I mean, they have good avocados, but they're always green. And So if you need some if you want to make some guacamole today, it's not going to happen. You need to think in advance and buy them in advance, because by the time they've been sitting there, all the little ladies have come by already and squeezed them, and now they're already guacamole inside the skin. So you don't want to buy those. Anyway, I just happened to think about it yesterday when I was at the grocery store. I thought, maybe I better look and see if there are any avocados. And sure enough, and there were a few ripe ones, and they were, I mean, almost ripe, and they were firm, so they're perfect today. So I got three nice big avocados ready to go. I'll make up some fresh guacamole, and we've got plenty of chips and salsa, and so we're going to have a big Mexican fiesta tonight.
Wait, there you go.
I'm getting hungry already. Now, I do want to say, but Paul and I talked about this a little bit earlier. I didn't know if I wanted to say what we were going to do tonight for dinner, because it is Cinco de Mayo, and that's a good time to celebrate with some Mexican food. I know there are a lot of people out there that are struggling to get by and doing what they can, and we wish them all the best, and you know, hope that things turn around here for the economy and jobs, et cetera. And we can only do so much as individuals, but as a group or groups collectively, we can do a lot, and that is by putting pressure on our elected officials to make the right choices and right decisions, and in the next election, elect the right people, the kind of people that have some experience and competence in running, maybe running, you know, an important business and industry, say a military leader, that kind of person. But in my humble opinion, community agitators have no business being in government. They really don't know how to manage or run anything, and they don't understand the budget system, et cetera. I mean, look at this last year. We had a Democrat House, a Democrat Senate, and a Democrat president, and they didn't even write a budget bill. They appropriated the money, but they didn't write a budget to say where the money was going to go. So naturally, we keep running out of money. Okay, it's taken care of for the rest of the year now, but in any case, what a joke. So this is the kind of leadership we're stuck with, but that's another story, and we've talked about that in the past. So anyway, Feliz Cinco de Mayo, everybody, and hopefully you're having a nice day. Now, I had said earlier, Paula, I'm having a great day, and the reason I'm having a great day is I had been in a jury pool since last Friday, and I don't know if you said anything about it when you were on the air the other day. By the way, good job of broadcasting with Bella. I'm glad Bella came on and helped you out. Bella D'Angelo, who has her own radio show every day. And you can find out information about her show by going to USA Talk Radio Network and looking at her page. We're in the process of linking up her page on our site with her page in the plug-in so that you can listen to her shows each and every day. And there have been some changes they've made, and so I've got to get the latest changes so that we can put that in there and it's functioning. But Bella does a great show, and I'm glad she came on, and she's always invited to come on our show anytime. Love having her on the show, and I'm glad it all worked out. But I was stuck in that courtroom till probably 5:15 on that particular day, so I'm glad you guys were able to take the show and run with it, and it sounded like you had some fun.
Yes, it was. It was a very good show, and I thank God for her.
Yeah, she's great. Well, I just contacted her that day and said, listen, Bella, I don't think I'm going to make it out of here in time. And so in any case, that all went on, and I did not get selected for the jury. And the reason I'm happy about this is not because I don't like serving my country. We all know that I like serving my country, but this was a very likely going to be a month-long case. It wasn't a criminal case. It was a lawsuit that was going on, but it was kind of a big one. And that's why they ended up using the entire jury pool on Friday, which started off with maybe, my estimation, 500 people. And by the time we were in jury selection, we had about 80 people in the courtroom that the lawyers had to, you know, question. That we'd already done questionnaires, but there's a lot of things for them to ask us. And if you've ever been on jury duty, you know that a normal jury selection is quite a bit easier. You're working with maybe a dozen people, and it depends on the state how many you need for a jury. I didn't know this, but in Florida, the number for a civil suit like this is only 6 people and 2 alternates. And I could swear when I was in California, and that's not even worth looking up, but I could swear when I served on a jury back then many years ago, we had at least 10 people on the jury and with a couple alternates. So, but I don't know, maybe it was eight, but it seemed like it was a lot more than six, you know. So we only needed six, so we ended up with six people, and I just really didn't want to, you know, have to be involved in that for a whole month. I like jury duty, but a whole month, not really my cup of tea, and so I was a bit stressed out about that, and it was a huge relief, huge burden lifted off of me last night when they started going through and selecting, and they did it in alphabetical order. And when they got to somebody whose name would obviously come after my name alphabetically, boy, that felt. And everybody in the room did a good job of not showing any emotion. A couple of the people that were selected went up and sat in the jury box, and they didn't look pleased. But in any case, but as we filed out of the courtroom, those of us that were then released, boy, there were a lot of people going, oh, my gosh, oh, thank goodness I didn't get selected. Boy, people, you know, just didn't want to have to do that for a month. And so that's just kind of the way it is. So I'm very happy today that I'm here on the show, doing the show with you, Paula, and not having to worry about that going, you know, the courthouse every day.
Uh-huh.
In another time, maybe, you know,
yeah,
it'd be okay. But right now, not good. So that was nice. In any case, we have talked a little. I don't even remember what we've talked about. We did the show Monday with Javier Manjares, who has the Shark Tank, and great guy, does a fantastic job. He was CPAC Blogger of the Year and selected unanimously without really even having to have a vote. So he's done a really good job in the last couple of years, and he just got the Shark Tank up and running. I remember when he first brought it online, going and looking at it and thinking, this is pretty cool. This is good. He's worked really hard, to get that site to where it is now. He's got lots of sponsorships and advertisers, et cetera, and he puts out stuff throughout the week. So if you're listening and you didn't hear his show, it was back on Monday. You can go listen to the archive of that on the webs on my page. And, of course, if you go to Blog Talk Radio, you also can see the archives if you go to USA Talk Radio. And that was back on Monday. So that was a good show. He was only on the show for a little bit, but yeah, check out the Shark Tank, and he's got a lot of good stuff there. And let's see. So we did talk a little bit about Osama bin Laden getting pegged, and a lot of things have happened since then, a lot of controversy and discussion. You know, we've seen the White House tell us one thing initially, then another thing. Going to put
right.
out the picture, not going to put out the picture. There's some things that disturb me, and this is nothing new in, you know, the news or whatever, but I just want to see what you feel about this, Paula. A 40-minute burial ceremony on a Navy ship for Osama bin Laden. One of our poor sailors, probably a corpsman, had to carefully wash his body and get it all ready so they could wrap it and then bury it at sea. What do you think about that?
Well, did it really happen, Tom? I mean, did it really happen that they spent 40 minutes? Because what I've been hearing in the news since Monday is they don't think it took 40 minutes to do that ceremony.
Well, you know what? And here's the interesting thing. It may not have. They might have just dumped him overboard with a bunch of chains wrapped around him, which is what he deserved. He certainly didn't deserve to be cleaned. The guy is a despicable, disgraceful monster. And he didn't deserve any kind of care.
No.
You know, we didn't have to parade his body around or anything like that, like they would certainly do with us, the terrorists. But,
nope.
You know, he really didn't deserve any kind of consideration. But for the White House to put that out and say that here's what occurred, here's the process, you know what they're doing. They're trying to not offend the Muslim world. And they're playing it up as, well, we don't want to bring any more wrath on us than we already have from terrorists.
Right.
I don't think that's possible. They're going to come and try and strike us one way or another. It really doesn't matter. This doesn't add any fuel to the fire. They are so full of hatred for us and our way of life that, you know, they're going to come anyway. Now, some folks would say, Tom, it's our occupations in the Middle East. We wouldn't be occupying anything if they didn't come over and attack us first. And so why did they do that? Well, mm-hmm. They did it because of our policies in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. What kind of name one policy that you can think of, Paula, if you can, that you would think might upset terrorists, Al Qaeda, and people like that in the Middle East? Well, I'm certain Israel is one of them, but a lot of people will bring up the fact that we buy a bunch of oil from, say, Saudi Arabia and countries like that. So our oil presence, in essence, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. That I would agree with, definitely.
Well, here's the thing about it. Saudi Arabia doesn't have to sell us a thing. Saudi Arabia doesn't have to enrich itself by selling us a bunch of oil. In fact, they could sell it to somebody else. So the terrorists, they're all upset about us, you know, being over there and being so entrenched business-wise in their lousy country. boo-hoo, you know. Your country doesn't have to deal with us. So instead of going after the customer, why don't you go after the proprietor, your own leadership? Now, we see that happening in some of these countries finally. My question is, why are you coming after us? We're just the customer. We're just the customer. If your own leaders and kings and sheiks and everybody else are going to sell us oil and deal with us and allow us to have a military base there and buy our military equipment, why aren't you going after them? Why aren't you terrorizing them? One of the reasons is, and you know, things have, I think, altered over the last decade or two, in that these leaders haven't had to crack down on their own people in a long time. Mm-hmm. But in the past, that's precisely what they would have done. It would have been, I've read books about how the Egyptians used to handle, you know, dissidents and terrorists within their own country, et cetera. It's brutal. I mean, you know, putting a pair of underwear on somebody's head and taking a photo of them like we did in Abu Ghraib, I mean, that's nothing. We're not even, waterboarding is nothing. I couldn't even begin to describe the stuff that they've done to their own people and the murders they've committed. And it's not just, you know, putting a bullet in the back of somebody's head. It's torturing them very, very badly and leaving them to die. You know, and that kind of stuff. So, but those kind of things have kind of dwindled over time to some degree, and I think some of these leaders in power have kind of forgotten that they need to crack down on their own people quite so much, because there's a scapegoat out there. It's called the United States of America. So these terrorists, I would say, look what your own leaders have done to you and your people all these years, and you're going to blame us for that? And here's the other thing about it, and I've said this for many years, and I say it in a different way that might more resemble the language of a sailor at sea, so I'm going to say it in the PG way, but the United States of America is one of the youngest nations in the world. We've been around for about 250 years, and they want to blame us for all of their problems over there in the Middle East. The Middle East has been around for thousands of years. It was a outhouse 2,000 years ago, it was an outhouse 1,000 years ago, it's an outhouse today, and it will be an outhouse 1,000 years from now. They want to blame us? They're full of baloney. They are their own worst enemy and problem. Arabs kill more Arabs than we've ever killed. Muslims kill more Muslims over there than we have in any kind of bombing raids or action that we've taken against regimes and terrorists over there. So this whole thing brings to the forefront what our administration's Middle Eastern policy is. We'll assassinate some people. Others, oh no, can't touch them. We'll get involved in some civil wars, but not others. We will speak out in favor of some leaders over there and speak against others. There's no rhyme or reason. If there was a policy and a clear direction of what we're trying to accomplish over there. But there really isn't. I think we've got – I know we've got a president who is incompetent and really doesn't know what he's in over his head. You know, that he took 16 hours after everything was set in place and the military was ready to go and his advisor said, you know, advised him. He said, I want to sleep on it. 16 hours later, he finally gave the go-ahead. I really don't understand the hesitation in – going in there. And it's not because, well, he didn't know if he wanted to risk, you know, soldiers' lives. Oh, no. The military already said, we don't have to risk any lives. We will completely destroy that compound. There won't be a living thing left. It'll be just burnt to the ground, a big, big smoking hole there. Mm-hmm. We know he's in there. He'll be dead. No, he want to prove?
I can't.
Why did he want proof? He's not going to show any of the proof to anybody now, though. So why did he want the proof? Well, it's all politically driven. All politically driven. You know, I know plenty of people, and maybe me being a military guy, I wouldn't have hesitated for one second. I say, okay, military, explain to me what your plan is to go in there and do. What are the options we have? Well, we can blow it up. I would have taken a few hours to think about, do I want to send people in there like we sent the SEALs in? Do we want to send people in there and risk not really knowing what's on the inside? And we didn't. That was a very closed compound. They, you know, had been hiding him there for a long time, and nobody was coming out, nobody going in except about two people. That's it. The neighbors had no idea what was going on in there. And so we didn't know what we were stepping into. Booby traps, lots of armed individuals, et cetera. We didn't know. So me being a fighter pilot kind of guy, I probably would have said, let's just blow the whole thing to smithereens. And it would be based on the intel we have. Do we really know he's there? And why? How do we know he's there? So, you know, that would probably have been my option. But I'm not going to second-guess somebody on the option they chose. I just think it's very telling that it took him 16 hours after everybody had laid it out for him and said, we got a couple options here. Well, no, I definitely want proof if we're going to do it. I think he looks at everything in political terms. He doesn't look at what's right. I mean, he can if he wanted to, and he may. But then he considers, how is this going to affect me politically? How is this going to affect me politically? 16 hours is a long time to try to decide on something that was really, quite honestly, a minor raid, minimal people involved, could have just dropped a couple bombs and destroyed the place, and that would have been the end of that. So I'm a little confused as to what this administration is trying to do. I honestly think that when the CIA and the military came to him and said, we know where he's at and we can get him, if he had said no, I mean, that would have gotten out. We knew exactly where bin Laden was, and Obama let him go or didn't go after him or tipped off the Pakistanis, and then the Pakistanis said, oh, gee, he got away. We tried to get him, but we just couldn't quite get him. So it was going to make him look bad. I think he really didn't want to do it. I mean, really did not want to go in there and get bin Laden. But he realized politically he has to at this point. So if he's going to do it, let's do it. So now that we've gotten some information, but we don't have information, we're not going to get the proof, but they were going to give us the proof, it just makes you wonder, what's all the flip-flopping and misinformation coming out? Can these guys actually do anything, you know, coherently? Obviously, the military can clearly go in and take out a guy like this and get him out of there and get themselves out of there. The military is competent. I don't think our commander-in-chief is.
But what would bring you to that conclusion that he was doing it for his political side? What brings you to that conclusion?
Because the military recommended just blowing it up and not sending anybody in. And I know for a fact that any time you send bodies into a situation like that where you really don't have very good intel of what's in there, you risk losing some soldiers. Now, soldiers have signed up to do this. They're very, very well trained. They've signed up to do this and this kind of stuff. That's why they're soldiers. And if somebody dies, they die. But as commander-in-chief, you have to weigh the risk versus the benefit and the probability of, you know, something going wrong versus the probability of it going okay and all those things. You have to look at all those things. The military had already done that. When the military comes and says, we'd like to just blow the place up and that'll be the end of it, they've already looked at the risk versus benefit and determined that the benefit of just blowing it up is better than the risk of going in there and trying to extract him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the military recommended. He said, no, we're going to go in and get him. Okay, then that's what we're going to do. He's commander-in-chief. He gives the orders. And that's okay, too. We don't know everything. And I'm not saying absolutely he did this based on politics, but I'm just kind of piecing things together. When it takes you 16 hours to decide to do it, he had already said, if we're going to do it, we're going to send people in. We're going to send a team in. So he'd already made that decision. That was really easy for him to make, that decision. If they had said, it took him 16 hours to decide, do we bomb it or do we send people in? Then I would think, boy, he really is thinking about our troops. No, he, on the spot, without any discussion, no, we're going to need proof. There's going to be questions about it later on. He had no hesitation sending our troops in. What he hesitated was whether to do it or not, period. So that to me tells me it's all politically driven.
But you're unsure as to why you think he would need the proof. You think it would be for his own satisfaction and his own benefit? No,
he's already been through an issue of his birth certificate.
Yep.
And that thing just festered and festered and festered. And just imagine if somebody like Donald Trump is all over the news every single day saying, I think Obama made this up. I don't think we actually got him. Yeah, we went and blew something up. We don't know he's there. I mean, we haven't seen him. And look, think about it. He's been in that house for 6 years. I mean, my gosh, he's done a good job of hiding. He just hasn't been out and about. And so I think the conspiracy theories just would run amok, and he didn't want to have to go through that again. So if I were president, I don't care. I'm going to do what's right. And if I thought that just blowing the place up was right, then that's what I would do. And now, because he wanted the proof, but he's not giving it out there. Well, we want to see a photo. Well, we don't think that's right. This has been floating around all over the internet and news and everything else, but we're up to this point now where the president has said, no, we're not going to put the photos out because that's just going to rile up terrorists and make it worse, and that's just not how we operate. He didn't hesitate to authorize or allow or not block additional Abu Ghraib pictures being put out. Now, I know that people are going to say, oh, no, those were already put out in 2006. Not all of them. Not all of them. And so I'm going to let's see if I just had the article up here, and now it looks like I might have lost it. I did. I'll go and look for that in a couple seconds, but I had the proof because I have an article from 2009 that talks specifically about the president deciding that he's not going to continue to block like the Bush administration any further release of photos. So he doesn't mind making our military look bad and riling up terrorists with more photos of terrorists, being put in compromising positions, not tortured, just not looking good, the way they're dressed or how they're standing or a hood over their head, et cetera. So he doesn't mind that. But a picture of a dead bin Laden, one of the worst mass murderers and worst enemies of the state in the last decade, at least, if not the history of our nation, now all of a sudden he's very sensitive to that. I don't buy that either. I think that's a bunch of baloney. What do you think?
Me personally, I think it's a tough call because I don't know, with everything that we've seen over the years, Tom, the death, the assassination of Martin Luther and Robert Kennedy and President Kennedy, I would venture to guess, to me, I would question why not show the pictures of OBL, but maybe, just maybe, hypothetically, he's taking into consideration the families that lost their loved ones in these attacks in this country and just said, you know what? They've been through enough. They don't need to see it.
Yeah.
Just
well, maybe. And that could be it. Now, for all the naysayers, here's April 2009. The White House plans to release dozens of photographs depicting abuse of prisoners by U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of the substantial number of pictures from the notorious Abu Ghraib jail, I would say Abu Ghraib jail in Baghdad shows soldiers intimidating or threatening detainees by pointing guns at them. Okay. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said it was unrealistic for the U.S. government to keep the photos secret. So these are not photos that were already out. These are additional photos, okay? So the president had decided, we're not going to try and block this any further like the Bush administration. Just let them out. Wow, okay. So you know, again, I see nothing but hypocrisy after hypocrisy from this administration. They say one thing and do another thing, and then do one thing and then say another thing. And this isn't much different. I could care less really about seeing the photo. I believe our military got Osama bin Laden. But for them to say, we're going to release the photo, no, now we're not going to release the photo. I mean, it's like the Keystone Cops. They say one thing on Monday, then they say another thing on Tuesday, and then another thing on Wednesday. To me, it just makes them look highly incompetent. Something that could have been celebrated by this president and said, look, we got him. We did it. Now, of course, he doesn't ever use the word we. It's all I. And I think this whatever speech he gave, I didn't listen to it. But I read that, and I wanted to go find it and see how many times he says the word I. You know, when I used to give political speeches, I never said the word I. In fact, I had a plant once in the audience who, and I'm trying to remember the context I did it, but I said, what word have I not said here today yet? And I can't remember if that's what it was. It was something else. But he put his hand up and he said, whatever letter. I is like the eighth letter of the alphabet or ninth, whatever it is. You know, I'm not going to try and count in my head right now. But I said, can anybody tell me what the eighth letter of the alphabet is? He goes, I. And he put his hand up. Real quickly, so he clearly was a plan. Everybody laughed. And I said, exactly. If you're looking for a politician that says that word frequently, I'm not the guy. Of course, I just said it right there. But I made sure I was careful not to say it. If you're looking for somebody that talks about we and us and getting things done together, you know, then look no further. So I really am amazed at how many political speeches I've seen where the either incumbent or the candidate just says I over and over, just talks about themselves the whole time. I just can't stand it. And so that was one of the things that made it very hard for me campaigning, was going to events where other politicians were speaking. And we're talking elected officials, and not even campaigning, but speaking on a particular subject, just talked about themselves and nonsense and stuff that was of no value to the people there. It was all about trying to sound good. And it just got really old after a while. I just got tired of going to different, political events, and especially events where other candidates were speaking. It just, and I think a lot of people could understand what I'm saying here, because I wasn't a politician. I never have been. I'm just a regular old kind of guy that decided to try and make a difference. And so I had to put myself into places that I would never have gone on my own, just as a regular citizen. Never would have gone to a lot of those things because I had no desire to.
I did come across an article that Reuters had put out called The Great Debate, to sanitize photos is to distort history, by Deborah Kopakin Kogan. Today, I don't know if you've ever heard of her.
She said
that she understands and supports President Obama's decision not to release the bloody images of OVL for fear of fanning flames. But she does think it's a slippery slope from national security concerns to the infantilization of a nation. She says Bush, by not allowing photos of dead American soldiers coming home for burial, acted no better than a Soviet apparatchik. That these newly released amateur photos, crudely shot with a flash of unidentified bodies littering the blood-covered floor of Osama's compound, have come to light through Reuters, she finds not only historically refreshing, but journalistically vital, perhaps even in an adolescent to adult turning point in the way we as a nation perceive war. There is another piece that you can go to on Reuters that actually shows you, was it two or three individuals that were killed besides OBL in that room that they show here online?
Yeah, I've seen those photos, and it's, yeah.
Yep.
War and death is an ugly thing, and that's one reason to, you know, avoid it at all costs. And it's just not a pretty thing. So, but anybody that's hanging out with that guy, Osama bin Laden, they can't be good people. Can't be. That's not the place to be hanging out. Now, I did see something. I'll look it up tomorrow. It was on Rush Limbaugh the other day, and he said a lot of people are celebrating, putting up T-shirts that say, Obama got Osama. Yeah, didn't he get Gaddafi's son also? And then I think he got one of Gaddafi's wives and a couple grandsons as well. And let's see, who else did he get? Well, he got, you know, a couple people there and besides Osama bin Laden, a couple other people there that were with him. And let's see, and this is the way I think Rush was putting it. He killed so-and-so and he killed so-and-so. And I don't remember all the different things he listed, but the one thing that made me laugh was, and he killed the economy. Now, I know the liberals out there are going to say, but George Bush destroyed the economy. George Bush certainly didn't help it, but I would say Obama killed it. So George Bush might have wounded it, but Obama killed it. You know, the reports coming out, I just heard today on the radio that in Detroit, there's some stimulus money they're giving out. Now, remember stimulus was for shovel-ready jobs. There's something like $1.5 million that's going to be given out to people, just given to them, to just, you know, not to work or anything, just hand it to them. 3,500 people are going to get the split up for, you know, for being able to stay in their house and make their payments and all that kind of stuff. That's what it's for. Stimulus money, $1.5 million for 3,500 people. They've got like 65,000 people that are applying for it. So, you know, unless you felt like you needed that money, I mean, there's going to be people that are just going to try and get free money. But that's a lot of people that feel like they're in extremis and need a helping hand. And, of course, the stimulus money is – I mean, does that seem like it's going to stimulate the economy by creating jobs, by just handing people money? I understand keeping them in their homes, but for how long will that last? It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. And, you know, why wasn't that money spent earlier? Why are we waiting until now? There were people in bad shape, you know, right after that stimulus money was authorized. So, I don't know. Did you hear about that, Paula?
You know, when I was doing my research the other day, and I don't want to get you off the beaten path with that, but I saw something that I thought that they were giving out stimulus money in that state for energy programs, but I could be wrong.
Well, they may be. They may be as well. But what I heard today was specifically stimulus money given to individuals for to homeowners that were trying to avoid default. Now, I just did the math. You know, 1.5 divided by 3,500, that's $428 to each person.
Hmm.
That might make one, you know, mortgage payment. So I don't know. You know what it sounds to me like? It sounds like what the Democrats typically do. They throw bones. They throw a little scrap out there to poor people and say, here's a scrap. You're getting it from us. And, you know, there was a lady that was interviewed that was asked, you know, what are you doing here? Well, I'm coming to get, you know, some of the – I seem to remember hearing this before, and this would have been previous stimulus money given out. But she was asked, what are you here for? And said, well, I'm here to get some of the Obama money. And the reporter said, Obama money? Where'd he get it? And she said, I don't know. It's in his stash. So you and I, the taxpayer, are paying for this, but President Obama's getting the credit like it's just money coming out of his own bank account to these people, and they're like, we love him, we voted for him, he's giving us free money. I mean, you know, so in reality, who were in charge when the stimulus package was put together? Democrats, and they've made sure that they'd be able to throw some scraps out there to poor folks in the cities, in the different, you know, large cities. So they feel like, well, you know, I got a $428 check from, you know, the president's personal stash. Yeah, I'm going to vote for him next time. And then Rush today was talking about how 47% of poor people can't read. And he did make an interesting point. He said, I bet they can read the letter D. So when it comes time to go vote, they vote for anybody that's got a D next to their name. Yeah, that's true. It's sad the way we round people up like cattle to go vote when they don't even know what they're voting for. And I see the unions do the same thing. I've personally seen it where union members, and these aren't poor people. These are smart people, you know, firefighters and policemen, and they've got a list that they've been handed by their union. Here's who you're going to vote for. How about I vote for who I want to vote for? Sorry, too important to the union. You're going to vote for who we tell you to vote for. And they show up, you know, like good little soldiers, and do it. Now, I'm not saying all do. I've actually talked with some folks that are like, hey, I vote the way I want to vote. But I've seen too many at the polling places with their little cheat sheets, and I've asked them, so who are you supposed to vote for? And they're like, I don't know, just whoever's on the list.
No kidding. I wasn't aware of that.
Oh, yeah.
No kidding.
So, now, you were talking about energy, and I like talking about energy stuff, but this is kind of, I don't know if it's related or not. The White House, this was today, the White House is putting out feelers on the Transportation Opportunities Act. Did you hear about that one? I love the way they phrase stuff. It's the Transportation Opportunities Act. It's going to be new opportunity, Paula, for you and I when it comes to transportation, new opportunities. And you know what the new opportunities are going to be? To give the government more of our money. That's the new opportunity for you and me. That's what it is. It's called the Transportation Opportunities Act. And let's see who wrote this. It was Tabitha Hale. I like Tabitha Hale. And you can find her on Twitter, and I think you see her frequently on Fox. Anyway, she said, it's very ironic because I'm not sure of one opportunity that this would provide for the middle class. Obama seems to be keen on assisting. If you think for a half a second, you'll quickly realize that we pay gas taxes every time we fill up our cars. And she's got the list there of the states that are the worst. In Connecticut, you're already paying 70 cents per gallon. It doesn't matter what the price is. The price could be 75 cents for a gallon of gasoline. You're still going to pay 70 cents to the federal government. Well, it's a combination of federal, state, and local governments. Okay, so now what the Obama administration is proposing is that we start paying for every mile we drive. So you'd have to get something for your car to retrofit to your car, and then all new cars would come out with a device that tracks, and we already have an odometer, but it transmits. When you go to fill your car up at the gas station, it transmits to the pump how many miles you've driven since the last time you filled up. And you will then be charged a fee on top of the gas and the gas tax that's already there, an additional fee for each mile that you drive. And now you think, who's going to pay for these new devices to go in the cars? We are. Who's going to pay for the gas stations to retrofit their pumps so that they can track this and then charge us the additional amount? Us. This is this is really the equivalent of a value-added tax on everybody, including the poor and middle class. Anybody who drives and relies on transportation to either get their kids to school or go to work or go to the grocery store are going to pay it. Now, let's say you don't have a car. And I see people do this every now and then, not that often around here, but you have to go to the grocery store and get some groceries and you don't have a car. You could take the bus, but you might not be able to carry that many groceries. It's difficult, you know, to carry a lot of groceries and go sit at the bus stop and then get on the bus with all those groceries. It's just too much for one person possibly to carry, so you have to call a cab. Now, the cab is going to be paying that new per-mile fee. And guess what you're going to pay? You don't even have a car. You don't even put gasoline in the car, but you're going to be paying it anyway because the cab driver's not going to absorb that. He's going to pass it on to his customers. So we're all going to pay more money, and this is what this administration is going to do, to look for ways to charge us or tax us, but sort of out of the box, you know, not an income tax, but a tax that we will all have to pay. Every single one of us. So no income tax. He's going to stick to that, but he's going to find every other way to nickel and dime us that he can, as well as the Democrats. That's what they want to do. And some Republicans want to do it too, to get more of our money without reducing the size of government. That's their holy grail. We can't reduce the size of government. We've got just too many important things going on. So we've got to pay for them, and we're just getting further and further into debt. So instead of going further into debt, we're just going to make you go further into debt and start taking more of your money. So that's the Transportation Opportunities Act. What do you think of that, Paula?
I don't particularly care for it. I just pulled it up in front of me, and it says that they're floating an authorization bill.
Yeah.
Now, how many people in this country do you actually think are aware that this proposed bill even exists, number one. Number two, do you think that anyone will do anything about it, or they'll just say, okay, it's another tax, it's okay, we're just going to go along with it, rich or poor?
Yeah, I think this is just a step. This is just putting your finger in the water and testing the water, see what the temperature is. I think this bill is not to authorize that to actually happen, because a lot of things have to go into place. You have to figure out, okay, how do you put this on cars, and how do you put these in the gas stations? This is to do the research to figure out so that somebody can come back and report to the administration or to Congress or whoever, here's how you would do it, and here's what the cost is going to be, so that they can then authorize the money to pay for that and get the ball rolling. I would hope that our Congress won't fall for that and buy that. And I think it'll ultimately, if the bill actually goes were to go to the floor in the House, it would just be shot down. But I don't think it would even make it out of committee, quite honestly. But
I would hope not. I would venture to guess that there would be a couple of people out there that would pretty much lose their mind over this particular issue.
Yeah. Now, I can guarantee you there'll be some Republicans that look at this and go, hey, this is a way to reduce our debt. And, they won't, though. This is what I've seen happen in other countries that have much higher taxes than us. Income taxes is they put a value-added tax on and then another tax, like up in Canada, for example, you got the GST and then the VAT, and they say it's just to get the government out of debt. That's it, just until we've paid off the debt. And they do. They pay off the debt. And then after that, they go, hey, this worked pretty good. We're just going to leave it in place. But you said it was just going to be there till, and you may be seeing this at the local level, where they say, we just want to raise the local sales tax one penny or half a cent for the next year to raise enough money to pay off a certain amount of debt, and then it'll be gone. Well, they never put into those proposals that it's automatically gone. They just say, then we'll end it once it's, succeeded. And then I have seen, I believe in California, where it's going to automatically end, in 3 years, and they put a proposal out for a new bill or an amendment to that bill that says it was supposed to end in 3 years, but we want to extend it 2 more years. And so what they do is they go to the voters and say, let's give us 2 more years. 2 more years, please. These things never end. They just never go away. And so that's why we have an income tax that started off being just on the wealthy to then just some more wealthy people to now it's everybody. Well, it's supposed to be everybody, but it's not everybody. It's the middle class, and then, of course, the wealthy, and the wealthy really have lots of ways of getting around it, so many of them really don't pay any serious income tax. But that was our next tax issue coming our way. And then now let's definitely talk about energy. This article came out from the Heritage Foundation and under the Foundry, and I guess that's one of the blogs. It says the Foundry promotes conservative policies and principles by marrying the best in public policy research with the day's current events. And so it says Obama's anti-energy policies are bankrupting America. And we're going to take a look at one particular company. In fact, Randall Stiley has witnessed firsthand the Obama administration's job-killing agenda. As the president and chief executive of Seahawk Drilling, he had to lay off 632 employees before filing for bankruptcy, a direct result of President Obama's anti-energy policies. They say, well, what policy was that? His company operated and owned 20 shallow water, not deep water, shallow water rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. The lack of energy production, a consequence of the drilling moratorium that affected all platforms, not just deep water, led to Seahawk's demise. Now he's speaking out, sharing Seahawk's story in a new video from Heritage and the Institute on Energy Research. Okay. So there we go. Job killing, because we're trying to save the planet, remember? We're trying to save the planet, so we've got to stop drilling because we can't afford any more oil spills. I agree. We can't afford any more oil spills. That's why we need to get rid of the Department of Interior that fails to do its job properly and inspecting. I think if you left it up to the state, instead of the Department of Interior getting those billions, $15 billion, you allowed that money to stay in the states that are on the Gulf and allow the states to do the inspections themselves, because the states are the ones that are going to pay the price when the oil spills, not the Department of Interior, not Washington, D.C. And I guarantee you they'll do a much better job of inspecting those wells and ensuring that they're complying. Now, you know that British Petroleum, the Deepwater Horizon, I believe it was called, that had the big oil spill, had something like 750-some violations over the course of a previous year or two that they just kept – now, a lot of them were probably minor, but they just kept having violations. And then we find out after the fact that the equipment they used in terms of the plumbing, the tubing, the structure itself, its design, not so much its design, but how it was built. It was designed one way, but it was actually in reality built a different way, with smaller structure pieces, et cetera. That all comes out after the fact. Where was the Department of Interior? I can't believe that they think they're understaffed with 11,000 employees and a $15 billion budget to say, no, we're just overwhelmed. There's just too many oil rigs out there for us to inspect them all properly. Well, then you're fired. Get out of here. Let the states do it. Let the states have the money. Keep the money. And the way I like to say it, keep the money to begin with and let them do it. Now, here's a good sign. Today the House, and this is today, May 5th, the House considers the first of several bills that directly address energy and jobs. Lawmakers will vote today on legislation that requires the Obama administration to conduct oil and natural gas lease sales. They've got us. If the Congress makes it a law, no executive order in the world can stop that. And we've talked about that before. Executive orders are unconstitutional. He has no authority to do that. But in any case, if it's the law of the land, he can't say, no, we will not conduct oil and natural gas lease sales. If it's the law of the land, he has to comply. His departments have to comply with that, and they will. So that's a good sign. And I know you sent me some energy articles the other day while I was in the jury box, but I didn't quite get a chance to look at them. And I know that I did. Maybe we'll talk about that tomorrow because we're getting close on time here. The last thing I wanted to do today, Paul, was read the article I wrote, well, letter to the editor that I wrote on NASA.
Yeah.
That got printed, I believe it was on Saturday. It came out Saturday, April 29th in Florida Today. So if you go to floridatoday.com, that's Central Florida's version, the local version of USA Today. That's owned by USA Today, so Florida Today. And there had been an article called The Final Four pushing the idea of more and greater involvement by outside entrepreneurs and outside companies outside of NASA in space exploration. And I agree, that's a good thing. And there already is that to some degree, but we can increase that. Now, we had Winston Scott on earlier or last month, and he talked a lot about this. And if anybody wants to find out more about NASA and get the straight scoop from a guy like Winston Scott, they can go to our broadcast from the 22nd of April and listen to that and hear some great stuff from Winston. And we'll have him back one of these days, less to talk about NASA and its future, but just stories. Some of his NASA stories. But here's what I wrote. It says Orion should be our next generation spacecraft. In response to the recent editorial Final Four, it is true that entrepreneurs have their place in NASA's broader goals for research, development, and exploration, but it is only part of the solution. The U.S. has long led the way in space exploration and the development of technology to further progress manned spaceflight. As the only nation to put a human on the moon, America must maintain this leadership role. A strong government-funded spacecraft, such as Orion, is the viable, proven, and best solution for our country as the space shuttle program comes to an end. Congress has asked NASA to launch a plan that accelerates development of the Orion spacecraft and the Space Launch System at Kennedy Space Center. Florida already has invested $35 million in the modernization of the Orion operations and the Kennedy Space Center's checkout facility due to the projected Florida jobs that will be saved with their completion. So what's the holdup at the federal level? A revitalized human spaceflight program is the key to long-term prosperity in Florida and the Space Coast region. Floridians should encourage NASA to wholly support Orion as the next generation in human spaceflight. So Florida's invested $35 million. The budget for NASA went up slightly from last year to just a little over $20 billion. And I know I throw this out there all the time, but when you compare that to, say, the Department of Energy that we get no return on investment from, which has an annual budget of $26 billion, what's the problem? Why are we sinking money into departments that fail us time and time again, and the one that doesn't fail us, we're thinking about cutting back on? And we did. The president did cut back when Democrats were in control of the Congress last year. He did cut back on NASA spending and their future budget. And then he gave a little bit of money back. But we're going to lose a lot of jobs there and expertise. And what happens is, Paula, when you then decide on down the road to ramp up and go, okay, let's get back on track with spaceflight, it takes years to get back on track, and you expend more money in the long run than what you ended up saving. So I'm concerned about it. I've written letters to Eder before, and I hope that we do have, for the Space Coast, the representative for District 24 is Sandy Adams, and she's very keen to the needs of not only the Space Coast, but the Kennedy Space Center. And I know that she will be working diligently with Bill Posey, who's just to the south in the next district, and he's also a big proponent of NASA and always does whatever he can to further NASA's ability to do its job. So the two of them, along with other representatives around the country from other space centers, hopefully will be able to find the money in the budget that's being wasted on useless programs and put it where it can actually do us some good, and that's NASA. So I wanted to read that, and I would have done that earlier in the week, but I really haven't been around. So we got that taken care of. But let's talk more about energy tomorrow, Paula, and
okay,
what this administration's doing, what the government could be doing, and where the real future in energy is outside of our traditional forms, such as coal, gas, and oil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that'll be fun. And then we'll talk about some current events as well. Anyway, to wrap things up, anything else that we should talk about here, Paula?
No, I think it's right now it's just the same old, same old. I know that the debt ceiling has some give until the roof falls in. That was something that showed up in the New York Times today. Federal government will not run short of money to pay its bills on May 16th when the federal debt reaches the legal maximum of $14.3 trillion. Thank you very much.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to throw another piece of news out today. If you remember, on one of our previous shows, Joan Flowers was on, and I was able to I know that my congresswoman's office is always receptive to veterans issues, but I have a little easier time getting a hold of folks because I'm on the Veterans Affair Committee or Veterans Advisory Board there. For her, along with some other great vets. But I talked with them about Joan Flowers, and what they told me, they gave me some good information that she needs to contact, and she's done it. She's in the process of doing that, contact the Veterans Administration or the National Archives to get his military record, his entire military record. Now, for her, I think that would be good just to simply have that. And so she's done that. She contacted the department, and they have sent her the form to fill out. Should get that filled out and sent back, and that may have already happened by now. And then once that occurs, then my congresswoman said their office will contact her congresswoman's office, who had told her, sorry, we can't do anything. Now, see what's going on here? We can do something. But her lame congresswoman wasn't willing to do anything. They'll contact her office and explain to them, if you make a phone call to the National Archives, you can expedite this and get her those records much quicker, like within a couple weeks.
Right.
And so they have agreed to help in the expediting process. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that when Joan gets those records, we can take a look at them, see what exactly what her father did do in World War II, and then see if we can get him finally buried in Arlington. So
that was wonderful.
That's good news, and I think hopefully we'll keep our fingers crossed that we can make that happen and make that a reality. But I just want to pass on that good news for Joan had been on the show back in April, and I think that was, let's see, it was on the 19th of April. It's a good show, and she's kept in touch with us on Facebook, and of course I talk with her on a frequent basis discussing this issue. So we'll see if we can get something done, and it may not be the traditional way of getting it done, but hopefully one day we'll get her there, and I will, when that occurs, I'm going to fly to Washington and go attend that service when he gets buried, so that'll be fun for me. Yeah, in any case. All right, Paula, well, it's been fun as usual, and time flies like crazy. I wanted to say a couple last things. Next week, Dean Black is going to be on Tuesday. We'll get some more information out about Dean on Facebook and the website. But Dean Black on Tuesday, great guy. And he's been in the radio business a long time. We talked the other day. about coming on the show and then a few other things. And he's now looking at maybe getting back into broadcasting one day a week via his local radio station. And when you hear his voice, you'll know he sounds like a classic radio talk show slash announcer kind of a guy. He's got a great voice, and he's a fun guy, and he's a true patriot. When I spoke with him, let's see, when was it? Maybe it was Monday or Tuesday, and he was all fired up about the United Nations condemning us for killing Osama bin Laden. So he'll probably want to talk a little bit about that, but whatever the latest thing is in the news next week, you know, early in the week, we'll see. But Dean Black's going to be on Tuesday, and I've got a couple other potential guests that we were going to have this week, but my jury duty kind of threw that off. So we're either going to get them next week, like Matt Falconer, or the week after. So we'll get the website updated, and I'll put out more information about the upcoming guests tomorrow when we talk, Paula.
Sounds like a plan.
All right. Well, everybody, thanks for listening in to the American Hour today. Feliz Cinco de Mayo. Happy 5th of May. And if you can do so, go out and celebrate by having some Mexican food at your local Mexican diner or cook some like I'm going to be doing tonight. But have a great Thursday night, and we'll be back tomorrow, Friday, at 4 p.m. Eastern, regular time, for another hour of the American Hour. All right. Good night, Paula.
Good night.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.